Welcome to Corporate Watchdog Radio, coming to you twice monthly to hold corporations accountable for their social, environmental, and economic impacts. I'm Bill Bowie, and I co-host this show with Sanford Lewis. Today, we will be looking at the Toxic Releases Inventory. The TRI, as it is known by its acronym, is in danger of being diluted. The EPA has proposed changes to the TRI that would reduce the amount of information and the regularity of the information being released to the public. We have with us Julie Gordy, Vice President and Chief Social Investment Strategist with Calvert, the socially responsible investing mutual fund company, as well as Jim Boyce, Director of the Environmental Program for the Political Economy Research Institute here at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. First up, we speak with Julie Gordy. Julie, you have used the Toxic Releases Inventory for a while and are quite familiar with it. Can you first start off by telling us a little bit about the history of TRI and why it was created?
Sure, Bill. The TRI was created in the aftermath, as so much of our legislation was, unfortunately, in the aftermath of a disaster. This was in the mid-1980s when, if you remember, the Bhopal disaster happened. This was a Union Carbide plant that blew up in Bhopal, India, and killed, in the end, thousands of people and injured many others, left them with long-term diseases and so forth. In the aftermath of that, Congress created the act. It's actually called EPCRA, the Environmental Protection and Community Right to Know Act, that created TRI, or the Toxic Release Inventory, that obliged companies to report on the their production and disposition of now 600 chemicals that can be toxic to people at certain levels of exposure, what they produce and what they do with those chemicals in the communities, facility by facility.
And how does Calvert use TRI information?
Well, TRI is one of those uniquely useful pieces of social information that we use as a financial firm. As you probably know, what we do in the finance business is very quantitatively oriented, and we're lucky to have TRI in that it lends itself to quantitative analysis. We can gather TRI information by firm, by facility if we want, by firm, back all the way to 1987. So we have almost 20 years' worth of data. And what we do with that information is we can benchmark it to the size of the firm. As we've heard already, some of the companies have huge TRI emissions, and sometimes that's just because they're big firms. And if we aggregated, say, 50 small firms that together would be the size of DuPont, we might find out, in fact, that their emissions are considerably higher than DuPont's. So what we want to do is kind of wash the size out of it and find out, you know, whether the firm is actually doing a good job of managing its waste or a bad job. So you can wash the size out of it by benchmarking it to some size measure like revenues or market cap or something like that. And then look at the trends over time. Are their emissions, their production of these wastes going down or up, and how does it compare to their peers? So I can compare DuPont to other chemical companies. I can compare Intel to other microelectronics companies, and really get a good feel for how this company manages its potential environmental liabilities compared with its peers. That, in our business, those are nuggets of gold or rubies. Quantitative data is really worth its weight in gold in the financial business, because it's a proxy for sort of the attentiveness of management to risks and opportunities, in this case, environmental risks. Now, we use a whole lot of different data sets, and this is one of them, but it's an extraordinarily valuable one because we have so many years' worth of data, and because it's quantitative and very complete.
Now, you've basically just laid out the incredible usefulness of TRI, and now fast forward to the present, and the Environmental Protection Agency under the Bush administration has proposed a number of changes to TRI. Can you just briefly explain what those changes are?
Yeah, they've proposed three changes, all of which are fairly dreadful. First off, they want to change the reporting period from annual to every other year. And actually, EPA can do this without any statutory permission. So, and in for finance companies, as you know, we tend to live in the present and the future. What we're pricing in the stock market every day is what we think that company will do, not what it has done. So up-to-the-minute information is extremely valuable in this industry. And if we have data that are 2 years out of date, or, you know, considering that it takes the EPA about a year to compile these data, in some cases it will be 3 years out of date, that's forever in this business. So changing the reporting period to every other year is a fairly consequential and fairly dreadful thing to do. The second change that they want to make is to withhold reporting, or to eliminate reporting on the disposal of certain types of chemicals. That they're called persistent bioaccumulative toxins, or PBTs. And I know that's a horrible mouthful, and most people won't remember it, or even really, when I say it like that, care about it. But if I say lead and mercury, most people will get it. You don't ever want to eat or drink those things. It will wreck your day. And that's what PBTs are. And if we're eliminating reporting of lead and mercury and other PBTs, that can really conceal some of the risks that people really want to know about if they're in their community, if their children are exposed to them, or, God forbid, if there's a fire or an explosion or a bomb threat or whatever there is. If those things are in the vicinity of a potential disaster, certainly first responders and communities really want to know if those things are there. The third change that EPA is proposing is to raise the reporting threshold by an order of magnitude from 500 to 5,000 pounds for many of these substances. And again, you know, we're not, it doesn't, 5,000 or 500 pounds, neither one of them sounds like very much when we're considering the size of the companies and the magnitude of, you know, substances that we typically deal with. But consider the fact that for many of these things, we measure toxicity in parts per million. And there are some of these substances that, you know, a few teaspoons is enough to kill every man, woman, and child in the D.C. metro area. You know, so when you're talking about 500 pounds, we're talking about an awful lot of toxic substances, and 5,000 is unimaginably huge. So, you know, all three of these are not a good idea.
Now, if you can, what are they... How are they rationalizing these changes? What is the logic behind wanting to make these changes?
Oh, boy. It's kind of tough for me to get inside the heads of the people who have made this proposal. But what they're saying, if, at least what I've heard them say, is that this comes under the rubric of regulatory relief, particularly for small business. That is, any reporting requirement or regulatory burden that relief that can be made for small businesses all to the good. Now, when the EPA put this out and opened up a comment period on them, I think they've gotten over 100,000 comments on them. And in many of those comments, we've gotten a fair amount of insight into what business people in particular think of the possibilities for regulatory relief. And many of the businesses that have actually responded to this have pointed out that these particular proposals don't actually provide much in the way of regulatory relief. In order to figure out whether their reporting thresholds are above or below the cutoff point, they'll still have to calculate everything. And so whether or not they still have to report, they still have to jump through most of the hoops they have to jump through now. So it doesn't provide a whole lot in the way of regulatory relief. There may be other options to provide regulatory relief that EPA hasn't considered, like electronic reporting or some kind of assistance with reporting or calculation or something like that, but those aren't on the books. Right now all we have is basically cutbacks in the type of reporting that's done.
So the old adage, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. It might be a little bit broke, but what I hear you saying is that these measures don't necessarily fix it.
Well, that's certainly what we're hearing from an awful lot of the businesses that have reported in. And, you know, there may be, you know, it's not easy to figure out sometimes what your report. I mean, I know I've gotten questionnaires that I kind of look at and go, oh, darn, I have to, you know, go back and figure this out and report this, and it can be a little bit of a pain. But, you know, when you consider what the benefit is of knowing what the toxic substances are in your community, if you're a citizen or a parent, or if you're police or fire department and you want to know what's there in the event that there's a bomb threat or an explosion or a fire, and you want to know whether you're really just fighting a fire or if you're fighting a potentially toxic release or, you know, a potential explosion that could be made substantially worse by a chemical that's on site that, you know, might actually be worse if you put water on it or something. That's, you know, the benefit is so much greater from knowing what's there. I, you know, this is just crazy.
Now, you've been amongst a group of folks who have been opposing these changes, a number of non-governmental organizations. What is your rationale for opposition, and what has the track record of that campaign been?
Well, we're very proud to be part of this coalition that's worked on this, and it's been pretty successful so far. In fact, competitors, in fact, in this business, the social investment industry, have also kind of stood shoulder to shoulder with us in trying to make sure that people were informed and aware of what EPA was trying to do and would write letters to EPA or to their congressman or their senator. And the NGOs have been just magnificent. In particular, the two that have really sort of carried a lot of the spears on this issue were OMB Watch and US PERG. And they visited an awful lot of offices on the House side, and now they're focusing on the Senate, obviously, to try to get some regulatory intervention, some congressional intervention to try to stop this from happening. And we're successful on the House side very recently in getting an amendment to the Interior Appropriations Bill that passed by, you know, particularly by the standards of the House right now, this particular House of Representatives, passed by a very comfortable margin of 231 to 187. It's called the Pallone-Solis Toxic Right to Know Amendment to the Interior Appropriations Bill. And, part of the effectiveness of what they did was in visiting each office, they were able to sort of go zip code by zip code and say, if this is done, these are the facilities and the chemicals that you won't know about if this happens. And this cuts across stripe and political leaning and every other kind of political division that you can make. Everybody wants to know where the poison is, you know, whether they're Republican or a Democrat or a liberal or a conservative, and that was an extraordinarily effective thing for them to do.
So it has passed in the House, this amendment, and you alluded to the Senate. So I'm wondering what individuals or groups of people can do if they are concerned about the erosion of TRI information and TRI in general. What can they do to help protect TRI?
Right. Okay, the way that the legislative process works, which often can seem, well, in fact, is kind of arcane at times, is that there have to be companion bills on the House and the Senate, and then they work it out in what's called a conference committee or in conference between them. So since this amendment passed in as an amendment to the Interior Appropriations Bill in the House, the best of all possible worlds would be to get a companion amendment to the Interior Appropriations Bill in the Senate. Now, the Senate at the moment isn't quite sure whether there's going to even be an Interior Appropriations Bill, which sounds kind of nutty, but, you know, this is an election year, obviously, and so they're going to be trying to wrap up business and get out of town so they can campaign. And not everybody in the Senate is campaigning, obviously. Only a third of the Senate is up for election because they have six-year terms. Everybody in the House is campaigning, so they get their business done a little bit earlier. On the Senate side, however, there's enough people that are up and, you know, need to go back home and make speeches that, you know, they may or may not, depending on how difficult they think it will be to get the appropriate bills done, they may decide to go for a continuing resolution, which will keep the agencies funded and operating but not actually pass an appropriation. So the best thing would be if there is to, you know, say, look, we do think there should be an interior appropriation, and if there is, we would really like to have an amendment to it or a clause in it that protects TRI in its current form and prevents the EPA from making these changes comparable to Pallone-Solis in the House. Now, the people in the Senate who at this point are probably going to lead that are Senator Lautenberg and Senator Snow and Senator Jeffers.
Okay. Thank you very much, Julie, for speaking with us about TRI here on Corporate Watchdog Radio.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to Corporate Watchdog Radio.
Welcome back to Corporate Watchdog Radio, and we are here with Jim Boyce, Director of the Environmental Programs at the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts. And Jim is here to talk about the Toxic 100, which Perry recently released the latest version of it and just started that program a couple of years ago. So Jim, I wanted to ask you the genesis story behind the Toxic 100. What prompted you to create this tool?
Well, first, let me tell your listeners what it is. It's a list of the top 100 corporate air polluters in the United States. The basis for this list is the TRI data, but added to what TRI itself provides is additional information that the EPA has created as part of a project it has called the Risk Screening Environmental Indicators Project, the RSEI. The reason EPA decided to add on to the TRI and create a richer database is that the TRI data themselves merely report the pounds of various chemicals that are released, hundreds of different chemicals by tens of thousands of industrial facilities across the country. That's really useful information. It's the information on the basis of which you often see press reports about who are the top polluters in a given locality. But this information has several limitations. One limitation is that the toxicity of the different hundreds of chemicals varies a great deal. Some chemicals are up to 10 million times more toxic than others. So pound for pound, they're quite different chemicals. They're way beyond the differences between apples and oranges, for example. And so in assessing the importance of these releases, it's useful to have toxicity weights that put greater weight on releases of more toxic chemicals. So that's the first thing that the EPA did as part of developing this RSEI database, was it developed toxicity weights taking into account cancer and non-cancer impacts, going through extensive scientific review processes. It took them years to do this, but they've developed state-of-the-art information on the human health impacts of these various chemicals. The second thing EPA decided to do was look at how these things are distributed in the environment. So the fact that so many pounds of such and such a chemical is released is useful information, but it's also interesting to know where that stuff goes, where do prevailing wind currents carry it, and how many people live there. And that's what EPA did as part of the RSEI. And the reason they did this was as a way to prioritize their own attention to polluters on the basis of their total human health impacts. When I learned about that data set, I realized that it would be possible to develop measures for corporations, not just for individual facilities, if we could assign the various facilities to their owners. The TRI data and the RSEI data that's built upon it simply are reported at a facility-by-facility level. That's what's made available to the public. In fact, as we discovered in this project, sometimes the facilities don't inform their own corporate headquarters of the information they're submitting to the EPA. Adding up these facilities to get a measure for the corporation may sound like a pretty simple thing to do, but in fact, it's pretty complicated. But that's what we've done. And we started out by looking at the top corporations in the United States, the Fortune, Forbes, and S&P 500 lists, which altogether gives you about 700 corporations because they have slightly different ways of deciding who's the top 500. So we looked at all of those corporations, all of their facilities, and we came up with company-by-company scores on the human health impacts of their toxic releases. We call that the toxic score. And that's what's available on our website for the top 100 air polluters. It's called the Toxic 100. If you Google that, you'll go right to it.
And for our listeners, the aggregation of the facility levels, the facility level information into a corporate-wide score is the most important thing, and that's really the main thing that you're adding to the EPA information, correct?
That's right. Yeah, the data itself comes straight from EPA. We don't do anything other than check for any corrections, subsequent corrections that have been submitted to EPA by the firm, so we have the most up-to-date possible numbers. But what we simply do is take the numbers that EPA itself has released and add them up by corporation, and that's something that otherwise is not available to the public. There are a few firms that help the socially responsible investment community by adding up TRI numbers by corporation, but those results aren't available to the public. And in our case, we're making it available to the public, and we're adding this additional information on human health impacts so that it's not just pounds of chemicals, it's actually a score that reflects how important those releases are in terms of human health in the United States.
Okay, and now how is this Toxic 100 list being used? How is it sort of generating dialogue and discussion about these issues in the public sphere?
Well, when we release the information, we send out a press release, and it immediately gets picked up by electronic and, in some cases, print media around the country and, in some cases, outside the country as well. So to give you an example, one of the websites that featured our Toxic 100 list when we released it last month is the website of an outfit based in London called Business and Human Rights Resource Center. I think their web address is www.business-humanrights.org. And they not only put our list up on their website, but also, as is their practice, invited companies, the top 10 companies on our list, to respond to the fact that they'd been listed as top air polluters in the country. And when those companies responded, in most cases they did, they posted the responses of the companies, and then they invited us to respond to their responses, and they've posted that as well. So there's a dialogue going on about the results of this ranking in cyberspace, available anybody in the world who wants to look at it. In general, this corporate level ranking is most useful, I would say, to people who are concerned with socially responsible investment, trying to assess the relative performance of different companies in terms of their environmental and social impacts. Obviously, this isn't the whole story, but it's a piece of the environmental part of that story, and it's one of the most sophisticated pieces of quantitative information that we've got about environmental performance.
Now, looking at the corporate responses, one thing I was struck by was GE's response. GE, as people might know, has really made headlines over the past year or so for really sort of jumping onto the CSR, corporate social responsibility bandwagon, and with especially its Eco-Imagination initiative. But it scored in the top 10. Now, it said that the EPA information is properly used for screening purposes only, and it is not a quantitative risk assessment model and thus not independently meaningful. What is your response to that?
Well, I suppose one can play with semantics here. It is a screening model. That's exactly right. It's the screening model that the EPA uses to assess human health risks and to decide where to put its attention in terms of investigating and, if necessary, trying to push remedial action when it encounters air pollution. Now, given that it's the database that EPA uses for this purpose, we simply are making that information available to the public in a way that they can use as well. Is it independently meaningful? I don't know. I don't even know what that phrase means. Independent of what? Of any other information? I don't know. It's a piece of information. It may not be perfect information. Very little information is perfect, but it's as good as we've got. It's as good as the government's got, and the government bases these numbers, of course, on what's submitted to them by companies like GE. I suspect that one of the criticisms that may be implied in that response is that in certain respects, the data that are collected by TRI themselves and used by the RSEI are imperfect. That's partly because of errors made by facilities in their own reporting, and it's partly because of the way that the data are collected. So beneath a certain threshold, the firm doesn't, or the facility doesn't, have to report the exact amount it releases. It can say we release between 10 and 499 pounds, for example. Well, there's a huge difference, especially when we're talking about very toxic chemicals. between 10 and 499 pounds. And we think that efforts to improve the precision of the data would help in making it even more independently meaningful than it already is.
Now, of course, that brings us right to the very issue that we're examining here, which is the proposed changes to the TRI, and that threshold would go up from 500 to 5,000 pounds. So I'm wondering, since Toxic 100 is a tool that is based on TRI information, what would these changes, what would their impact be on the Toxic 100 list?
Well, it would impact on the underlying data we use, the TRI, and therefore it would also impact on the data that EPA itself uses in order to create the risk screening environmental indicators on which we rely. It would be a dilution both in the quality and the quantity of the information that's available to the EPA and to the public. The dilution to the quality involves the raising of that threshold that you referred to, which differs depending on the class of chemicals in question. But basically, it would allow facilities not to specify a number, but just to specify a broad range below a certain amount, which is a very imprecise way of collecting information. And as I said before, in the case of highly toxic chemicals, that matters. In the case of things that have relatively low toxicity weights, it's probably not a big deal. But in the cases of things that are quite toxic, it is a very big deal to erase that precision in the data. The other thing, of course, that EPA has proposed is to switch to an every other year reporting basis. That is a dilution in the quantity of information, a 50% cut in the quantity of information. If it were the case that from year to year there was very little variation in chemical releases, that wouldn't be a big deal in that one could interpolate between years to get a sense of what was happening in the year that was missing. And if there's a smooth trend so that we know that it's going up or down by a given percentage every year, we could make a pretty well-informed guess as to where any facility or corporation was in the missing years. But if you look at these data, you find that there's a lot of year-to-year variation. One of the reasons for that being that some of these releases are not routine releases, but are accidental releases. And firms are changing in terms of their products and in terms of their technologies, etc. So by skipping the every other year, you're really losing a big amount of information. So in both respects, what these changes would do is weaken the public's right to know.
Okay. And now looking forward, what are your plans for the Toxic 100 over the next years?
Well, what we hope to do is extend the Toxic 100 in several respects. The first is to cover not only the top 500 or 700 firms in the country, but all the firms, regardless of their size. And when we do that, we'll need to figure out a way to take into account differences among firms in size in coming up with rankings. We'll probably use revenue as a deflator, so we'll have toxic score per dollar revenue as a way of comparing big firms and small firms. The second thing we will do is we're getting the complete set of data going back to about 1990. So we'll be able to look at trends, not just levels, but whether companies are improving or the reverse over time. And the third thing, and to me possibly the most exciting, is that we're going to be able to develop a measure of the extent to which the toxic releases from individual facilities and from corporations, from their parents, disproportionately impact low-income communities and people of color in the United States. As I mentioned, in developing this database, EPA looks at the number of people impacted. It does that using census data, and the census also reports on income and race and ethnicity of the populations affected. So by digging into the data and pulling that information out, we'll be able to develop a measure not only of the extent of human health impacts from a given facility or a given chemical or a given firm, but also of the extent to which they're disproportionately borne by certain communities.
Thank you very much for joining us here on Corporate Watchdog Radio.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Corporate Watchdog Radio, coming to you twice monthly to look at corporate accountability for social and environmental impacts.